Good morning, golfers. Welcome to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Pleased to be joined by the man, the myth, the legend, Woody Lashin, back for another, for our 10th season, a delayed 10th season, but a 10th season nonetheless. Woody, so glad to see you finally in person for a while. How you doing, bud?
Oh, I'm doing great, man. It's great to see you, even though it's behind a mask.
Exactly.
It's great to be back. 10th season, amazing.
I mean,
absolutely amazing.
Time really flies when you're having fun. As you know, I really enjoyed this journey we've all been on, even though the last year was a little challenging. And that's really what I want to talk about to start. Just because in some ways we're sort of reintroducing ourselves again. But no, just talk a little bit about the trials and tribulations. I mean, it's been an extremely challenging year for everyone personally and professionally. How are you doing?
Listen, I'm doing great. The thing about golf is that it was one of the few things that we could do during the shutdown.
Sure.
We were shut down for 12 weeks. When we got back open, we didn't know what to expect at all, and what we got was people want to play golf.
Yeah.
What I couldn't believe was the amount of people that came to me and said, you know, I got clubs from you 25 years ago, and I was playing, and then all of a sudden I had a family, and I had kids, and, you know, I put the clubs in the garage, and then the pandemic came, and I said, oh, we'll go back and play golf. I love this.
Right.
So many of those people come back to the game. I think a lot of people that maybe played from the Tiger era,
right,
when golf was just, you know, booming,
right,
they're back playing the game.
Yeah,
you've got new people, you know, wanted to get in the game, because one of the things you can do, I think, for our sport, you know, it's a silver lining.
Sure.
To what's happened, you know, personally, right now, our store, Mineola store, is going great. Unfortunately, our store in New York City is no longer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's fallout from the pandemic.
Yeah.
I will tell you that right now, our fittings are booked a month in advance. I think it's middle of May, I think, is the next available slot we have.
Right.
Which is a great thing.
Sure.
There's a whole supply chain demand. So once you get fitted, then trying to get your clubs is a whole extra battle that we've been having.
Yeah.
Because golf is exploding, and there's all kinds of problems in the supply chain, from the, you know, getting containers over from overseas, getting them through customs. It's
materials in,
yes,
general.
Yes, it's quite challenging.
Yeah, I imagine. In fact, I just heard on the news not long ago, there was even a shortage. One of the problems when the canal was blocked up was that there was a shortage of the actual containers. Right.
Yes.
So while all those containers were floating in space, they didn't have floating in the water. They didn't have enough containers to fill goods, or, you know, they had more goods than they had containers for the next ship, for the next load of shipments.
People don't realize how that you're going to feel the ripple of effect of that in the golf business.
Right.
For
right.
a year or two at least.
Do you find that, first of all, I'm just glad. I'm a firm believer that, you know, good things happen to good people, and I'm glad that I understand the sort of the juxtaposition between a pandemic and a boon for your business, and how interesting that feeling must be, because, you know, we're dealing with a virus that has taken a lot of lives and whatnot, and it's been. But I'm happy that your business is doing well. I'm curious, any particular part of games that people are going for fittings? It's still majority irons. Is it drivers? Is it putters? Is it wedges? Where are people flocking to?
I mean, it's equal access across the board.
Really?
There's no one thing or the other. I mean, in general, I think people are always looking for a better driver. They feel if they can get off the tee better, they can play better. But it's across the board, I think. Mm-hmm. What we see is once one person comes in and sees that, you know, we can either help them or we'll be honest and tell them not to buy anything,
mm-hmm.
That when they're ready to change something, they'll come back. And so that they'll do one aspect, they're like, oh, wait a minute, I wasn't going to change my irons, but maybe I should look at them.
Right.
You know,
so
I came
a little cascading effect.
I came in to get a new driver. They told me, don't change anything. Well, let me check my irons. And then mm-hmm. they go and check their irons, and they find, oh, the irons are off. So it's all across the board.
Right, right.
It's all across the board.
Yeah, that's interesting. Right before the pandemic, actually, I had just gotten the putter fitting with Sonny. And it's just amazing to me how much you can learn from. You know, I still think that putting, the putter fitting, is still the most underrated aspect of fitting. And close second might be wedges, to be honest. But, I mean, the putter fitting was, again, I had gotten it, my previous model I had done with Kirk years ago. And that was, and my second fitting was with Sonny much later. And equally, both of them were eye-opening experiences.
Well, I've always said that if you're going to do one fitting, it should be putter fitting.
Yeah.
And it's the one we do the least of.
Right.
Because people think, oh, I can putt, and they don't realize, you know. But I think one of the things, most things you get from a putter fitting is that you get education of what you're doing in your stroke.
Yeah.
You know, you can get education with doing your golf swing, but you can't really do anything to fix that. It's too, you know, you have to get professional help.
Right, right.
With your putting stroke, on the other hand, there's a lot you can change very easily if you understand what you're doing, and if you understand what your tendencies are, they're shown to you, and you understand that, oh, this is causing me to do this, so I should change this. You can get a lot more out of it.
And the average golfer can go get a PGA instruction. They're not, and the average golfer is not going to necessarily go to a Brad Faxon to fix hip putting or shortcut. You know what I'm saying? So to inform, right, we're better with information, and to inform people of what things they might be able to help themselves, I mean, that's really what putter fitting
sometimes
is.
Sometimes it also might make them think, I have to go seek out that professional because I'm doing this.
Right, right.
It's information that can only help you.
Sure, sure. So you guys are booming. Everything is going well.
Golf course superintendents are the unsung.
The shop is hopping. You talked a little bit about supply chain and the disruption. How has that affected the product releases from the manufacturers?
I think the manufacturers right now are all just trying to make as much product as they can of what they have.
Right.
We've seen a couple companies discontinued some stuff and not replace it with a new version.
Okay.
Because they probably can't make enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen some manufacturers have a little longer shelf life for certain things,
mm-hmm.
Than they might normally have because they can't get the new product.
Yeah.
But you know, all these manufacturers have these amazing engineering teams, and so their stuff is coming every year, it's going to be better because from these engineering teams. And
right.
And the pandemic hasn't stopped that. Those guys are still been working, and they will get it figured out. The bigger problem isn't so much from a head standpoint. So let's say, you know, Callaway's got a new driver that they're going to, you know, work on. The new head they can get. Question is, can they get the shafts, can they get the grips?
Right.
They're not making those themselves, and those seem to be more of a problem,
right,
than getting the heads.
Is the fallout of the pandemic and the disruption in the supply chain, has it been equal amongst the manufacturers or the OEMs, or has it been some been more affected than others? Can you even talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is they're all having big problems.
Okay.
So, there are some that have less.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the companies that are assembling in California they have the pandemic rules, right? They can't they can only have so many people. They can't produce maybe as much as they certainly did pre-pandemic.
Sure, the workplace is limited.
Correct. The places that build in Mexico, they're less affected by it.
Right.
I'll give you an example. At Ping, they're talking about how they can't get people to come to work, so they've made their executive staff have to pull one shift a week on the assembly line, building golf clubs.
Wow.
Because they need qualified people to do it. So
good for them.
Exactly. Well, that's they're doing
what they have to do
to try and, you know, get out the product as best they can.
Yeah. That's what was that show, like My CEO? Right.
When yes.
You're building. You got your CEO on the factory floor. You got to do what you got
to
do.
Yeah. Well, I think they at Ping, it's you have to. Everyone has to start and learn from the ground up, no matter what you're doing. So,
right. That's amazing. So the releases, now when do you suspect or can you even project everybody to be back online?
It's hard to say. I think right now they're focusing all on trying to deliver what they have now, and you know, I'm sure they have plans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really want to talk about what the approximate plans might be, because
right.
I think, you know, this could be changed. It's got things that you would think are coming in the fall that might not come till the spring.
Right. Now, these guys obviously are, you know, obviously have all this production and planning down to a science, clearly. And so they have versions or editions of clubs that they may want to come out. I don't know how far they extrapolate out to, right? But do they even, if the 2020 never even makes it out, does that even come back, or do they move right to what they would have done next?
I think they would, if they've gotten something better, they can move on to something better.
Right, so they'll just scrap that whole plan, whatever they thought was going to be the fall of 2020.
Right, well, because you got to understand that it's so far in advance. I mean,
right.
You've got
right.
engineering teams working on stuff for 5 years from now.
Exactly.
So as things go along, if you've got something better, when it's time to go to production, you're going to go with what you have that's better.
Right, right.
By the way, that whole thing is, you can design something, and can you build it? Can you
right.
get the materials? So it's a very long process for them to get things together.
Right. It's not a matter, you know, 20 might have been something that's going to be released in 2020, but that was being planned for in 2015.
What I would tell you is that in 2021, from every manufacturer, we have the best product that we've ever seen.
Really?
This is the best year. There are very few PEAT products that we like. We don't really like.
Mm-hmm.
The manufacturer have done a fantastic job of designing and building great equipment this year.
Can you give us some examples of, like, maybe not favorite, like, you know, Mizuno is always a solid company, always producing. What is it that has made the difference, do you think, this year particularly?
I think they really have improved some of their products. For example, their 921 forged. Over the 919 forged, they really made some substantial changes there that will make a consistency difference
mm-hmm.
For the player that would play that golf club.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, tremendous. It's like, I want to say it's like the fourth edition maybe of that type golf club. They've been making something like that for a long time, but
mm-hmm.
They really improved this year over last year. We saw a big jump in performance. And, you know, was that with Mizuno? Well, that you go from, you know, driver down to wedge and putter. They've got good stuff throughout the whole line this year.
Mm-hmm.
They, 2 years ago, they didn't even have putters.
Right.
Now they've got a great putter. So they're doing everything they can to make the best products that they possibly can, and they've done a phenomenal job.
Specifically about the 921, what was the change in technology that may have aided in the improvement? I know we'll have Vauchel on at some point. I could
let's let Vauchel answer that question.
gotcha.
I could be here for the rest of the show here talking about that.
It's got to be interesting to you, though, as a fitter.
Well, it's very interesting. That's where we have those conversations with the guys.
Yeah, I mean,
because we want to know why they did what they did and what
right.
they think that the results are going to be, and then can we go see and get those results?
Right, and
when we do, okay, it's fantastic.
So how did you get given the pandemic, obviously no one was going to the PGA show, how did you get that information? Now, for those of you listening who don't know, Woody and Pete and the crew, they go and they basically interrogate all these engineers down in Orlando. No, but they have these quality days with them to understand, you know, the line of thinking, the technology that's coming out, why, as you said, designed things the way they did, and what were they expecting the outcome to be, so that you understand that the results, whether it matches their outcomes or not, and that you could give them feedback and say, hey, you expected A, but we got B, or you expected A and you got A, or whatever the case may be. How did you meet with those guys, and what did you do in replace of that?
Well, we did a bunch of Zooms. Mm-hmm. Not the same.
No,
not the same. We always do our own testing, so it was a little bit harder this year.
Yeah.
But, you know, we did it. We're hoping that if the things are better come this December, we'll be able to go back out to California and
right.
talk to those guys and get get the stuff for next year. But it was not an easy year to do. We did it. The Zoom stuff was okay. You know, you got some information. You got to talk to guys. These engineers are so brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
They have, you know, so much information to give. And a lot of our discussions were based on, you know, longer drivers, USGA, you know, lowering the length of the driver and, you know,
right,
things that
right.
we can do in our fitting.
Right.
But I think we got to get Joe on.
Yeah, we got to get Joe on. So we're going to take a short break. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsese. We'll be back in 90 seconds.
Pete's Golf. Since 1979, Pete's Golf has been practicing the art of club fitting and has been selected as a top 100 club fitter by Golf Digest magazine. At Pete's Golf, we use the best technology available to create an exceptional fitting experience for every customer that walks into our store. Visit Pete'sGolf.com or call 516-248-6891. That's 516-248-6891 and get your next set of clubs fit for you.
Golf course superintendents are the unsung heroes of our great game. Due to the game's efforts, we now have turf that needs less water, courses that are more sustainable, with many now offering natural wildlife habitats. From the days of old Tom Morris, golf course superintendents have given golfers a reason to love this great game. But don't take my word for it. Jack Nicklaus agrees.
If you love golf like I do, thank a golf course superintendent.
A message from the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America and local superintendents everywhere.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Fochelle with Mizuno. There's no better feeling than having your clubs perfectly dialed in, and with over 2,000 authorized performance fitting partners nationwide, it couldn't be any easier to get custom fit using Mizuno's revolutionary Shaft Optimizer 3D. Find the right shaft and match it with any of our legendary grain flow forgings or our award-winning hot metal irons featuring high-strength chromoly. Visit MizunoGolf.com to find the nearest authorized fitter in your area, and remember, nothing feels like a Mizuno.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. I'm Anthony, and in the across from me is Woody Lashin, co-owner of Pete's Golf Shop, and on the line is Joe LaCava. Joe, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no, thank you. Really appreciate the time. Wanted to start a little bit about you, and maybe just get after a little bit about you know how you started in golf, and you know, growing up, were you a golfer? And how it led to a life as a caddy?
Good question. Yeah, I did play golf growing up. I wasn't very good, but I did like the sport.
Welcome to the club.
Still not very good, but you know, I enjoyed it. You know, I made my high school golf team, which wasn't a big accomplishment. We were all chops, but I had fun with that. I was more of a baseball guy growing up in the early days, and then my dad took me out for my first round. I want to say I was maybe eighth grade-ish. And immediately I fell in love with the game, and the fact that I thought I could maybe play, you know, varsity golf as a freshman in high school was kind of appealing to me. So I kind of left baseball at that point and started playing golf. I've been playing basically the rest of my life, you know, at 57 years old. And then, you know, I never went to school, college, you know, thinking I'm going to become a professional caddy. I don't think that was ever a thought. But it was just one of those things where obviously I got fortunate, got pretty lucky working for the first bag was Ken Green, who was my cousin. And I fell in love with the tour caddying part of it when I used to work for Ken 1 week a summer at the Westchester Classic. You know, back then it was the old Hanover and changed names to Buick, the whole nine yards.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it more as a fun thing working for my cousin. You know, I loved the competition stuff, but I was just a bag toter. I wasn't doing anything on there. I was just trying to stay out of the way.
Sure.
Back in those days. I enjoyed my week, but again, it never was one of those things where, geez, I'd like to do this when I got out of school kind of thing. So again, golf definitely in the background and got, you know, like I said, got fortunate. And then when I did get out of college in December of 86, Ken was kind enough to ask me to do it full time. I hadn't had a so-called real job at the point lined up. And, 2 weeks in, he asked me to do it full time in 87 and I was all in.
What was the, were you not a business major when you were in college? And what were you, if I'm correct, and if so, what was it that you may have thought you were going to do?
Yeah, I did. I was a business major. I got a finance degree. You know, my dad worked in a bank. So I was always going to kind of go maybe where there was a connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back then it was one of those deals, you know, coming from Newtown, Connecticut. Basically back then, this is in the 80s again.
Sure.
There was only one game in town, only one bank in town. And my dad was in the mortgage department. So he kind of, you know, he got to know a lot of people that moved into town.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew a lot of people in other banks in Connecticut. So I just thought, you know what, there's going to maybe be a connection there. Maybe I'll go into the banking business and see what happens, kind of thing.
Sure.
And so, fortunately, I've never actually been on an interview, and I've never had a real job.
I hear you. That's amazing.
Yeah. So that was the plan, and then, like I said, it turned. I mean, I don't want to say it turned for the better, because a lot of people are doing very well in banking business and finance business, and I love that kind of stuff. But I wouldn't trade my gig for a minute.
Joe, when did you know? Like, how many? One weekend, 2 weeks in, you're like, oh, I want to do this. Did it take a while? Did you say, I'll try it and see if I can get a real job?
No, that you hit it right on the head. My very first tournament was 1987 Tournament of Champions out in Carlsbad. And again, same thing. I was just a bag toter staying out of the way working for Ken. And we were driving to Palm Springs for week two from Carlsbad, and he asked me if I wanted to do it full-time. Because originally, my thought was to just go out to the West Coast, have a good time, because I wasn't lining up any caddy stuff. This is back in the summer. Of 86, I got three jobs. I normally had one full-time job in the summers. I got three, saving all my money, because I had never actually been on an airplane. The furthest I had been from Connecticut was the Jersey Shore. So I said, you know, it might be a good time to go out, hang out on the West Coast, have a few beers, watch my cousin play some golf, and just enjoy it for 5 or 6 weeks, and then obviously get serious when I get back and get a job.
Right.
And then, like I said, backing up to that first event, 2 weeks in, he asked me to do it. And like I said, I always loved doing it when I worked in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But to be out on the tour, seeing California, that kind of thing, and then I think one of the stops was Pebble Beach up there and stuff like that. So obviously you love the caddying part of it, but to see the West Coast and the tournaments out there, that made a pretty easy decision to go ahead and say yes. It was no hesitation. I was all in.
How long do you think it took you to go from just being a bag toter to being a professional caddy and really, really helping him on the bag?
Yeah, another great question. You know, like I said, I grew up playing golf, so I feel like I know how to read greens. That's the only part of my game that's halfway decent is putting. So reading the greens is not an issue. You know, getting a feel for the golf courses and stuff like that and getting the local knowledge of the golf courses takes time because you want to see them several times. and then, you know, back then, you know, the yardage book that we used was very, very basic. they had a guy provide one, but you had to do a lot of detailed work. Fast forward to today, everything is kind of pretty much done for you in that yardage book. There's still plenty to do. It depends how much knowledge you want for your guy. But to answer your question, it probably took me, you know, I think about halfway through that first year, Ken started letting me, you know, kind of do the yardages and carry a yardage book and get more involved. I was always involved reading greens, but Ken was a very good putter, so not a ton of that. But, you know, he knew I could read them because we played enough golf together and stuff like that. So I would say between 6 months to a year before I felt comfortable kind of just basically doing my own thing. And then, you know, when I went on to Fred, I went from Ken, who was, you know, hands-on because I didn't know what I was doing, to 3 years later, now I'm in the mix, and, you know, Fred didn't never carry a yardage book or anything. now he's doing everything, you know, yeah, he just, you know, he didn't want anything in his pocket, didn't want to think. He just, you know, is it a 7-iron? Yes. You'd like a cut, you like a draw, kind of thing like that. So that's when I really, really got in the game. And that's, I mean, I enjoyed it with Ken, obviously, but I enjoyed the canning a little bit more because I was really involved.
Do you have a memory back with Ken, like a call where you called him off a club or you called him off a shot that, you know, really worked out, or something where you, the opposite, where you talked him into something and it was bad?
Well, I've done that plenty of times. That's a very long list. But, you know, a couple times, like when he won, the thing about Ken is, you know, he won five times over his career, and if he could smell victory or smell blood, he was going to get after it. In 88, you know, the first time that I'd won with him, he won two times in a row, and we were at the Canadian Open, and the group in front of us, I should remember, but I don't remember, the guy ends up making five, but, you know, Ken is basically leaning on his three wood on 18 at Glen Abbey, and, you know, probably many people out there know what it is, but it's a par five that's reachable over water, and the water goes right up to the green, so there's no room for air if you come up short, but if that guy had made a four in front of us, Ken was going to hit the three wood. And then, you know, without hesitation, he grabbed the 9-iron to lay up once the guy made five and stuff like that. But I was kind of in that fairway trying to talk him into maybe just laying up regardless.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I thought, you know, if you lay up, you're going to make four or five probably at worst. And if you go for it with a three wood, you know, you're going to bring a lot of numbers into play.
Sure.
And as good as his wedge game is, his putting is, that to me anyways at that time, I thought, you know what, let's just make this a three shot, or worst case scenario, we're in the playoff and we'll give it our best shot then. But again, back to the, you know, the Ken series, he was a very, very good fairway player, fairway wood player at the time. He was never probably not going to hit three wood there. So I do remember that because, I mean, maybe because it led to the victory and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's one that stands out to me. And one of my favorite Ken Green stories is, you know, in 1988, he had played great at the Greater Greensboro Classic in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And he played great for 71 holes, hits a drive down the very last to the right side to a back left pin, hits a 9-iron in there about 25 feet short of the hole, basically where he wanted to, knocks his first putt off about 2.5-3 feet short, ends up missing the putt with a one-shot lead. Sandy Lyles in the clubhouse. Now we're going to go to a playoff. And, you know, to this day, this is 1988 now, to this day I remember trying to get him to shake off that putt, because this is a guy that from 3 or 4 feet in, it doesn't sound like much, but he never missed. It always hit him in the back of the center of the hole. It was a very, very confident putter. This really shook him up. And by the time we got done on 18, so I think we went to 15 for a playoff, I couldn't get his, you know, frame of mind in the right spot. So I kept telling him, listen, who cares if we win in the playoff or the regulation? Let's just get it done in the playoff. I did everything I could. Long story short, ends up bogeying the hole. We lose in the playoff to Sandy Lyle. I think 3 days later, I see him down to Florida for, you know, just to practice. And he says, I can promise you one thing. I'm going to win that tournament next year. And I thought to myself, all right, you know, you're frustrated. You're still mad. We're all still mad, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, a year later, we go to Greensboro in 1989. He'd been playing okay. Hadn't done much that season. This is back, the event was back in April. And he goes on to win the golf tournament. And I tell people, you know, people always want to talk about Tiger and Fred. That was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. He did that just based on guts and determination and the fact that he missed a three-footer 12 months earlier. No, obviously he liked the golf course, played well in 88. But still, that doesn't mean a year later you're going to just win the thing because you're frustrated you missed a two-footer to win the thing to begin with. So that was one of the most amazing feats that I think Ken pulled off in when I worked for him for those 3 years.
It's amazing what a professional athlete can do, as you well are aware, caddying for Tiger as well, but and Freddie. But what a professional athlete can do when they're super hyper focused on something, it's just mind boggling what they could do. I'm curious, did caddying ever feel like work to you? I mean, because it's easy to, you know, people listening or young kids who might hear, think, oh, you know, here you are, a young guy in college or just out of college, and you're kicking back, having a few beers and on the West Coast and going to Pebble Beach, and it sounds like all fun and games. But at some point, it stops being fun and games. The honeymoon period is over a little bit. There's a lot of travel involved. But did it ever feel like work to you, or no?
That's another great question. You know, we always talk about the fun times and the wins and stuff like that. I mean, there are times where, you know, I feel like, yes, all the caddies work very hard the week that they're at an event, preparing for the tournament, and then obviously during the course of the week. But, I mean, to sit here and say, you know, it's hard work, I don't think a lot of people are going to feel sorry for you working for, you know, Fred Couples for 20 years and now Tiger for the last 8 or 9, and then, you know, fortunate enough to win with those guys at a couple nice events like TPC and Augusta. But, you know, I think the physical work can sometimes be tough, especially as I get older. And I don't want to sound cheesy or cliche and say I've never had a bad day at work. You haven't. But, I mean, there are frustrating times when, you know, more so with Fred because he hit the ball so darn good a lot, didn't always capitalize with his putting. So there's frustration involved.
Mm-hmm.
But never really felt like work. Like I said, I'm sitting there. You know, listen, let's keep this a secret here, but, you know, I worked for Fred for 21 years or 20-plus years, and Tiger for the last 8 or 9. I'm working, you know, 15 to 20 weeks a year at the most,
mm-hmm.
you know, making a nice living. My guys always make the cut. They contend often, and they win pretty often. So, I mean, pretty hard to sit here and say I've had a tough road to hoe, you know what I mean?
Can you give us a little, like, a behind-the-scenes, like, the week that you're working? So, like, you know, what do you do? We see you on TV and you're carrying the bag, but what things are you doing that we're not seeing?
It's mostly at the beginning of the week. You know, I always like to go out on the golf course on my own before Tiger. I'll just use Tiger now because that's the latest. Before Tiger gets into town, and if he usually gets in on Monday ish, give or take a half a day. So I always make sure that I've seen the course at least once without him, and then I'll send him a very long, detailed text on how the golf course is playing. So you can get a feel before he even jumps on his plane and gets into town how the course might play. I'll say, listen, it's kind of firm and fast right now, and based on the weather, I can see these guys getting it firm and fast. Other times I'll say, listen, it's going to be soft, it's going to be hot. I don't see him getting it firm and fast. I'll tell them, you know, how the rough is, up or down, you know, where it's nasty. And then I'll certainly tell them if there's any changes, you know, to certain holes, so we can get an idea of that. Although he's going to see it in the pro-am and possibly the practice round, I like to give him as much information as possible because that's how his brain thinks. So that's Sunday or Monday for me, getting into town, getting a lay of the land. And like I said, besides three venues, these courses are all the same. So I'm still going to go out there because it's my personality. I may go out there twice just because I don't want to miss anything. Not that I'm Joe Caddy. Like I said, it's more my personality, just wanting to see the golf course. When we went over to Carnoustie, I didn't see that in the previous British Open. So I walked that actually four different times before the thing started on Thursday. Because, wow, number one, those courses are just different anyways, and the wind can always change direction. The funny thing is, when you go to the British Open, you know, when you walk that golf course initially on Sunday before the tournament, you know, sometimes you get in the habit of thinking, okay, wind's blowing this way, this hole's going to play this way, but yet it can change in a minute over there versus more so over here. So you got to almost anticipate the wind turning and changing, so you got to be careful with getting all your numbers because, you know, a 30-mile wind over there, it makes a huge difference. Stuff like that. So again, I'm going back to the Carnoustie thing, walking that four times. But normally it's just a good solid once over. And then, like I said, I'll look for other stuff during a practice round or a pro-am. And then once the gun goes off starting on Thursday, my routine is to get there a couple hours before our tee time. The Tiger will show up an hour, 15, hour and a half beforehand. He'll, always go to the putting green first, and then he'll usually hit some chips, then to the range and back to the putting green for 5 or 10 minutes. And then it's off to the races, you know, Thursday through Sunday with a 4 to 5 hour round. So, the days are a little bit longer at the beginning of the week, and that's where you do your prep work. And then once the gun goes off, the days are a little bit shorter. And, you know, with Tiger, with the back surgeries and even Fred back in the day, not a ton afterwards between, you know, between their age and the fact that they've had some back issues.
I want to shift gears because I know my worlds are colliding today because I get to talk golf, I get to talk Rangers, I talk to the Giants, and I do want to get to Augusta, given that it's Saturday and moving day at the Masters. But let's put that on pause for 1 second. Let me ask you: are you more bullish on the future of the Rangers or more bullish on the future of the Giants?
Wow, these are some great questions. I would say that's kind of a toss up. I mean, as we all know out there, you know, regardless of being a Ranger, Giant fan, or you're New Yorker, you follow it a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, they're both kind of going in the right direction, we'll say. Mm-hmm. I don't think either team is there. You know, watching the Rangers this week on Tuesday, you know, they look great. And then, you know, they're going to come back Thursday and probably not going to beat Pittsburgh. But then to follow up last night and beat the Islanders was solid. So,
yeah,
you know, you have one night when you're thinking, oh, my God, we're going to actually make the playoffs and make a run. And then you have some nights where you're thinking we scratch and claw for a goal and we're not going to get there.
Yeah.
But I like the fact that, you know, JD's got him going in the right direction with some youth, and playing the younger guys. Panarin's phenomenal. I think they had good goaltending. But like I said, sometimes it's just frustrating because they scratch and claw for goals. I think sometimes what frustrates me the most about the Rangers is, these guys need to be more selfish. I think, you know, they're always looking for that extra pass. And I understand the extra pass might lead to a better opportunity, but I feel like they just should just shoot more and be a little more selfish, some of these guys. And then just look for rebounds and stuff like that. Listen, I'm on my couch thinking I'm coaching. You know, I think I'm, you know, Barry Trotz or whatever, which I'm not. So that can be frustrating at times. But like I said, I think they're going in the right direction. I think they've probably got to go, 13-3 probably realistically to make the playoffs.
Yep.
With the Bruins having so many games in hand. But we were talking about it the other day. My buddy and I were playing golf. And, you know, he's like, oh, it's only been a couple years. I said, it's been more than that since they put that, you know, letter out saying, you know, to rebuild and be ready, be patient. You know, I'm ready for them to make the playoffs and at least maybe win a round or two. And as far as the Giants go, you know, some nice stuff in the offseason, as you guys know, with the tight end and the receiver in the corner. You know, I'm old school, you know, taking me back to the George Young and Ernie Accorsi days where you build through the draft. But I understand, you know, that's not the way the game is handled now in the offseason. So I like the moves that they made. I still like to see some, you know, work done to the offensive line because, you know, the poor kid needs some time and obviously Barkley needs some holes. I don't care how good you are. But again, same thing with the Giants. Seem to be pretty young, going in the right direction. You know, the division's nothing special, so I certainly expect the Giants to win the division this year.
I couldn't agree more. I'm a little more old school too, and a big fan of George Young and Ernie Accorsi. I really feel like in terms of the Giants, I do think that they sort of had a little bit of a crisis of leadership, and to some degree, I know John Mara Listen, Wellington Mara wasn't perfect, and George Young wasn't perfect. I mean, they hired Ray Hanley, and you know, so you know, I know there's going to be some lean years, and you, as well as me, know, you know, we lived through the late 70s and the early 80s, so we understand. But I didn't like some of the things that were coming out of the leadership of from central office, if you will, from the Giants and John Mara. I didn't like the way they handled the Eli Manning benching. I thought he deserved better than that. You know, there were certain some things, you know, and then all of a sudden Robert Tisch says he's got to come in and overlook things and start showing up at the office at Giant Stadium. I just didn't like, I always thought that they were the Maras and the Rooneys, and they were sort of the gold standard of ownership in the NFL. And I just didn't like what I was seeing from the Maras per se. But it seems like things are maybe starting to with Joe Judge coming, you know, being a great hire. It seems like things are turning around a little bit.
No, I agree with you there wholeheartedly. I think Judge is going to be fantastic. You know, I just hope it's one of those things where, you know, he doesn't really peak with his team his second go round. You know what I mean? It's tough first time coach. You got to give him time. It seems like the guys want to play for him. He brings these guys in like Galladay. He doesn't go to see anyone else. He must have sold them on it. And, you know, he doesn't put up with anything. And, you know, like I said, I think he's still a decent enough guy where he's not a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the guys know what he wants and they're willing to listen and play hard for the guys. So I do love that.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things that they said, that when guys on the roster start calling other guys or free agents and saying, you want to play for this guy, that's definitely right. A good sign, for sure.
For sure.
Do you think that if you look at all the drafting, you know, if you aggregate all the draft analysis, it seems pretty much three things, either to the wide receiver, an edge pass rusher, or an offensive defensive lineman. What do you feel is a maybe more of a priority than others?
Well, you know, you hit it right on the head. Growing up, you know, like I said, we're 70s and 80s guys.
Yeah.
And then obviously the last couple Super Bowls, you want that edge rusher.
Yeah.
Easier said than done.
Yeah.
So I don't think if there's a standout edge rusher, at 11, then I'm a big believer in the offensive line. You know, you can't have enough, you know, Chris Godfrey's, Bart Oates, Brad Benson, the kind of guys.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I love those guys.
Me too.
Gettleman seems to be on board with that too. The kid from Oregon will be gone, but again, I'm not a scout, but there's got to be another solid offensive lineman. I don't even care where. It doesn't have to be a guard or a tackle. I mean, it could be any of them. Or I would obviously prefer a guy that could play maybe a couple of positions on the line, but
yep.
That would be priority number one for me in the first round. You know, I miss the days of, you know, Ernie used to seem to grab a great guy in the third to fifth round. I mean, it turned out to be a standout guy, so I'm hoping we can find something like that where you have a starter that maybe got drafted in the fourth round.
Yeah, I agree. I personally think that the as let's say as attractive as another wide receiver would be, I still think you got to go offensive line to me, because if you're all in on Danny Dimes, and you have to do what you can to protect him, and it's been, you know, it's getting to that point, and you would know this just from golf. Confidence is so important for a player. Especially at that level, and you know, you can't get this guy in, you know, develop happy feet syndrome if he's always constantly looking over his shoulder.
100% correct, without a doubt.
And then switching back to the Rangers, I agree with you. I really love what JD's got them going. I know being a Ranger fan trying to find a rational Ranger fan is very difficult, but I do like where Dan Quinn has been. I do like the youth that they have. I mean, it's been a long time with, you know, as you well know, we've mortgaged the future so long for the present. It's just nice to see young people, playing the game for the New York Rangers. I mean, how good is Adam Fox? I mean, he's amazing. And then K. Andrew Miller too. Like, how good has he been last night? How good was he last night? Just that youth being served on the Rangers is a new sensation for Ranger fans to feel.
Without a doubt. Like you said, it's nice to have these kids. I mean, some of these kids aren't even 20, I don't think. But
no.
Yeah, to have those guys, and then like you said, maybe have a couple of veterans in the mix like Kreider and Strome. It's a nice mix of guys, and they seem to, you know, you see them go off the ice with the Kreider standing there. They seem to get along very well, and you hear good stories about the locker room. So like you said, I mean, I think the nucleus is there. I don't know what takes them over the top. I think they're a couple games over 500 now.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a tough stretch this year, which would be another disappointing if we don't make the playoffs. But like you said, I mean, they brought this kid over from the Russian kid came over. He looked pretty solid.
Yeah, Kratzoff, yep.
Yeah, and the defense looks decent. So like you said, I mean, like you just talked about, I mean, you feel like they almost should be better than they are.
Right.
You kind of scratch your head why they're not. I understand they've, you know, in a pretty tough division this year.
Sure.
With them changing it up. But still, at the same time, I feel like we're just as good as anybody. I mean, we own the Capitals, it seems like, but yet, you know, Pittsburgh kind of owns us at times, and the Islanders kind of have our number, and so we'll see. I mean, like I said, I expect a good stretch here. Hopefully they win the next four or five games, or win four out of five, and at least keep a little glimmer of hope going for the last 10 games.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's overlooked is the fact that, you know, the fact that they are young by a year, I think, not just the youngest
right.
team. I think they're younger by a year, and so I think that's part of what you were alluding to before with your frustrations is that I think the youth is part of why they're inconsistent, right? I would have preferred, and personally, I think some of that falls a little bit on Kreider. I think he's always been a little inconsistent, and although he's had a really strong year, I think, from a playing standpoint and from a leadership standpoint to some degree, I still think he could do more in terms of helping players understand the importance of consistency. But when you're dealing with really young kids, I mean, kids are inconsistent. I mean, that's just the way
right.
it is.
Yep.
So
you're going to get that mix, like you said, with the younger kids. You got the good and the bad like that.
Exactly. All right, let's get back to it's moving day at the Masters, and you know we're talking about Augusta and one of the most amazing properties in the world of golf, if not the most amazing property. It's basically a Disneyland for golfers. Talk a little bit about everybody talks about it's a golf course of experience. And maybe if you could talk to us a little bit or give us some examples of some of the nuances of that property that you only learn through experience that the first year Joe LaCava wouldn't have known, but the second year and the third year would have known.
Another good question. You know, the first thing I think of, well, the first two things I think of when people come there, they say, I want to go walk the golf course just to see every hole. And that's usually what everyone does for the first time. And they don't realize, and obviously TV doesn't know justice, how hilly the golf course is and how much elevation change there is. And back in the day, like I said, I keep talking about the good old days because I'm so old, but you know, they only showed the back nine back in the day. Now they're showing every hole. And people don't realize, how, like I said, how much elevation, how hilly the golf course can be, how hard a walk it can be. They're like, I'm exhausted after just walking 18 holes. And I said, yeah, try doing it with a bag. So I think that's the thing. And then as a caddy, you know, getting that elevation, because like I said, back in the day, we didn't have that in our books. And luckily I worked for old school guys where you give them the number on the ground and then you just kind of adjust and say, oh, it feels like it's playing 10 yards up today or it's half a club or maybe a club down, stuff like that. But the trickiest thing for me to learn, and I still haven't learned it completely, is the wind. Because the wind can swirl there with those trees because they're up so high. And it can bounce around. So there's no consistent wind. And you always have to be ready and you have to be checking other flags and stuff like that to know where the wind is. And again, sometimes you're still guessing. And you'll see guys come up with a little blank stare like, oh my God, it wasn't blowing that way a minute ago. I think somebody said that happened to Rom yesterday. And
yep.
It's very common there. And the difference is, on those holes, like where Rom hit the water on 15, you have to be so precise that even a slight wind change or the wind lays down just for a minute makes a big difference, because it can only be 2 feet, 3 feet here and there where you hit a decent shot and the ball ends up in the water or maybe, you know, going over the green kind of things, and that's very, very penal there. The other thing you notice about Augusta is if you're there and you're paying attention, looking up as a caddy you are, maybe not as a spectator, is they have a tendency to trim the trees, prune the trees, so that the trees lean into the fairway, which makes the shoots coming off the tees even tighter. And then, you know, it has that look of, okay, I can pick it up over this tree, and then you don't realize how high it is or how much it's leaning into the fairway. And you can hit a ball that maybe is just on the edge of the fairway and get knocked down by a tree. And go back to 2019, you know, kind of the funny story is when Tiger won there, you know, I was walking the golf course on Sunday morning, and I went out there, and they were having to drive, chip, and putt on 18. So I didn't go up 18 at the time. I did later in the day, but in the morning on Sunday, I didn't. So I went out there to the right side, and I said to myself, I've been here 20-something years. I didn't realize how much the trees overhang on the right if you're on the right side of the fairway. And I thought to myself, I don't remember that years past, but maybe I just wasn't paying attention. And so then sure enough, come to the 72nd hole that day in 2019, that's exactly where Tiger hit it. Not that that made really a difference in anything that he did, but I was saying the same thing, thinking to myself, you know, he's actually in the fairway here, but he's got to cut this ball, you know, 15, 20 yards, because you're going to start at 10 yards left of the tree branch. You're not going to try to get a yard from the tree branches.
Sure.
And that's exactly what he did that day. So it's stuff like that where as a caddy, you got to pay attention to certain little things where you normally wouldn't do that on a golf course. So I'm not saying it's tricked up by any means. That's just how they do things down there. And, you know, it's, we accept that and we know that, and it's going to be just a little different.
I'm curious as from your standpoint, from my standpoint as a spectator, having gone there and having gone to a few professional tournaments, it seems like when I get there in the morning that there was a vacuum cleaner. The place had been, you know, vacuumed spotless. Not a feeling that I got at any place else. Did you see anything different with the conditioning or how they do things there?
It's pretty amazing how clean the place is. They have guys walking around picking up garbage all day long that you don't even see. And I don't know what they do overnight, but they've been known to, you know, bring a, I've been told they've been known to bring a 70 tree in overnight and have it planted. Sort of got it. Looks like it's been there for, you know, 100 years. That's just what they do there. It really is amazing. And I think, and, you know, like you said, in terms of dictating the golf course, you know, they have the sub-air, and they can kind of do kind of whatever they want. And that's the thing about that place. You know, you go there Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, it's consistent, the speed of the greens, but you'll come out there Thursday, and you'll be like, what happened overnight? They, you know, they flipped the switch on, so to speak. You know, they can't do much about Mother Nature if there's some rain today, but they can kind of basically dictate the speed of the greens, which I absolutely love. And then to sit there on Thursday and see how firm and fast is playing, you know, it even frustrates me more sitting here in Connecticut not working, because that kind of layout and that kind of golf course and the condition that it's in would be right up Tiger's alley. And it's one of those things where you don't have to make 100 birdies. You don't have to shoot real low. And it's just, you know, like last November, it took some of the skill and the craftsmanship out of it by the course playing so soft. I mean, it's great that they had it. We're under tough conditions and they had it and everyone enjoyed it. But for one guy to shoot in the 60s every day and 20 under to win, that's not what they want. So I think they knew that going to this year. They were going to certainly try to make it play a little tougher. So I love the way it's playing firm and fast. I think it's only been that way that I know of four or five times. And Tiger loves those kind of conditions, so it's frustrating not being there. But like you said, the conditions are immaculate, and it's crazy. And like I said, I don't know if they have a crew out there working overnight, but it wouldn't surprise me if they do, because like you said, there's not a blade of grass out of place every time you go there.
I always said that the Masters, unlike any other tournament, was constructed in some ways like a four-act play. It's a limited field in the sense that, you know, you've got the past champions and the amateurs who you probably aren't going to think are going to be challenging, although Fred Couples, your old boss, probably always liked to show up and make a fuss on, definitely up at least until Saturday, and in recent years even until Sunday. But it's always been an interesting four-act play. Do you see it like that at Augusta? They almost construct it like they're building to this crescendo to the second nine on Sunday afternoon. Is that the way you look at the Masters as well, or do you see it different?
Somewhat, you know, like you said, that's the say. What do they say? The Masters doesn't start till the second nine on Sunday. And it's true. You know, nine times out of ten, they'll set those pins up so they're certainly more accessible. You know, starting on 14, where you can bring it in from the left or the back and stuff like that and give you plenty of opportunities to make birdies. But, you know, I also think, you know, you hit it right on the head. I mean, it's a limited field. Some of the older guys probably aren't going to do much. The amateurs aren't going to do much. So you have, you know, between 40 and 60 guys you got to beat. Obviously, anyone can win.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean the 60th guy can't win. But, you know, there's going to be a certain 10 or 15 guys that are probably going to be up there year in and year out that you have to beat. And I don't think that makes it easier.
No.
I don't think the field is weak by any means. It's just a shorter field. But you know that, you know, you're like when Tiger won, even when Fred won, when I worked for them, you know, you get up there on 13T, you know, you got to make some hay. You got to figure, you got to play, you know, 200 or 300 because the guys in front of you are going to do the same. There's plenty of opportunities to be had starting on 13. You know, 10, 11, and 12, you're trying to get through with pars. But starting on 13, you better be pretty aggressive. And like I said, be ready to make maybe an eagle. And I always think you got to make at least 3 birdies coming in and play those last 6, 200 or 300. Otherwise, you're going to get lapped by those guys in front of you.
Sure.
Take a look at the leaderboard and tell us, give us an idea what you think, who's going to play well. And
well, we got Rose at 7 under. You got Zalatoris and Harmon at 6 under. Leishman 5. Spieth 5, and then a double bogey worth of players at 4 under. At Wiesberger, Finau, Thomas, Kim, Cameron Champ, and Matsuyama.
Yeah, the good news is I think if you're just a general golf fan out there, everyone has their favorites. I think it's going to come right down to the wire, right down to the last hole. I don't think you'll see anyone kind of bust out and win by 3 or 4, although I think there's a couple guys capable of doing that. Obviously, you know, I'm not going to tell anything you don't already know. I mean, if it's me and I'm a betting guy, you got to look at Spieth. JT, I think, will be in the mix for sure. Those two guys are the first two guys I think of. You know, Schauffele, I know, has played well there in the past. He's a few more back than those guys. And Tony Finau, we played with him in the last group in 2019, so obviously that was just 2 years ago. He actually played pretty decent that Sunday. He just couldn't make any putts. If the putter gets hot for him, he's a little tough to beat. As far as he hits it, as high as he hits it. Spieth obviously has the hottest hand coming off last week. He's obviously got some confidence, and I think that goes a long ways with anyone, but certainly with Spieth because he's more of a mind game kind of guy. So he needs some confidence and needs to see some shots hit well and some putts go in. And now obviously that's what's happening, and you can see the difference. I mean, between a month ago when he was just kind of hanging around, had 2 or 3 good rounds out of 4, he was building towards this, and now you can actually see the confidence in his eyes. So I think he'll be very tough to beat. But those are the 3 guys I would look for. But, you know, Matsuyama, you know, he hits a very high ball and a very long ball. He's got a good game for that. Champ, I don't know much about. I know he's a good, obviously a good player and hits it very long. And Rose, you know, he lost there in a playoff to Sergio, so he's got some success there as well. But like I said, the good news is I think it's going to come right down to the wire and you're going to see a lot of good golf this weekend.
Yeah, I think it'll be exciting as it most times it is. I was just thinking about the vibe there at Augusta. Every major has a distinct vibe, I would think. I know that it's a major championship and everybody's hyper-focused on their individual performance. How would you describe the different vibes amongst the different majors? The Augusta, you know, obviously Augusta's played in the same place every year, so that's a different vibe. And then the Open Championship, the U.S. Open, and the PGA. What's the vibe like at each one?
You know, the vibe is great at each one, and I'm not going to say this because we're sitting here Saturday of Masters Week, and I've been fortunate to work for guys that have won that thing.
Right.
I think what separates Augusta, you hit it right on the head. You know, the fact that it's the only one played at the same venue, ton of history there. Guys absolutely love the golf course; they love everything about it. You know, from the time you drive down Magnolia Lane to the way they treat you in the clubhouse. You know, they got a separate champions locker room. Like you said, the golf course condition-wise is always going to be second to none. It's going to be fantastic. I think what helps their cause, too, is a couple things. You know, not everyone lives in the Northeast or, you know, the Midwest and stuff, but it's springtime. You know, it's kind of like, oh, my God, spring's here. It's also you haven't played in a major in, you know, 8 or 9 months. So it's building and building and building. Now you're going to turn around and have another major, the PGA, which is a fantastic tournament, a week later, mm-hmm. and obviously the U.S. Open and the British. So the fact that people are hungry to play golf, want to get out and play golf, millions of people watching it. You know, like I said, just a history thing, very hard to get a ticket to go to this event, you know, probably harder than maybe going to a Super Bowl kind of thing.
Yeah.
Kind of a bucket list thing for people. And, you know, and you hear the pros say, you know, I don't know if they actually say it, but you can tell that this is the major they want to win more than any of them, for the most part.
Right.
I mean, you may have some of the European golfers want to win the British Open more, understandably so. But if you asked certainly most of the American guys if they had a pick an order, in a perfect world, wouldn't be the favorite tournament to win, Augusta would probably be on the top of everyone's list.
Yeah.
So I think it has all those things going for it. And everyone, like I said, knows what they're getting into. The fact that they have a green jacket and all the things that come with it are pretty special. That doesn't take away from the other majors that we go to. I love working all of them. The British, for me, is a very close second in terms of, you know, tournament that I would like to work and have my guy win.
Yeah.
and that doesn't take anything away from the U.S. Open, the PGA. Those are fantastic tournaments as well. But there's just something about this place. You know, the crowd's very well behaved. You know, you get that tradition of lining up your seats before the tournament even starts. And how hard it is to get a ticket and how special the place is puts it, you know, a little above the other ones, in my opinion.
Sure. And I don't think, anybody wouldn't, what golf fan wouldn't want to be invited back to the Met, to Augusta right. every year and anytime sure. they want to go. So,
sure.
But Joe, I just can't thank you enough for coming on the program this morning. I appreciate the extended, time you gave us and, you know, be well. Look forward to seeing you back out on the golf course with your man. And thank you very much for your time, bro.
Well, I appreciate you keeping me on, too, because all I got ahead of me is yard work today.
Well, glad we could help.
Make sure you get that TV on this afternoon.
That's right.
So I'll watch some of it for sure. I can't wait. I'll probably watch a little of the Yankees first. Bad loss yesterday, but hopefully they can come back and win today.
You got it. All right. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate your time, man.
Thanks, guys.
Take
Thanks,
care.
Joe.
All right, professional caddy Joe LaCava, obviously world fame professional caddy. Everybody knows who he is, and obviously providing some wonderful insight into the world of golf. In addition to the Rangers and the Giants,
he was great. I tell you what, we got to have him back on because the detail that he was talked about,
right? I mean, the pruning of the trees, right? Augusta doesn't think do they not think of everything. I mean, it's amazing, right?
Yeah, it's interesting that you wouldn't know that, right? I mean, you wouldn't notice. He would notice it,
right? Exactly.
It's
and he's to be fair. Yeah, I mean, he's right. You wouldn't notice the pruning of the trees, obviously, from TV, right?
Which right.
is how most of us. But it's just fun to get that kind of insight to realize that they're purposely pruning certain sides of the tree. So that they know it's going to lean.
Yes.
And
yes.
And so, which is, you know, no detail is overlooked there.
I told you, when I went there, you know, you got there in the morning, it looked like they took a vacuum cleaner to the place. I've never seen a golf course that was that, you know, immaculate.
Yeah. It's amazing. Well, Woody, our time is up. I really appreciate you coming. We're going to be back next week for another hour. We're doing we'll have our show from 8 to 8:30, and then we have the Golf Institute with
Kelly Brook.
Kelly Brook from Bethpage. So looking forward to that as well. So we got another exciting week ahead of us. Enjoy the Masters, and Woody, always good to see you.
Thanks, Anthony. See you next week.
See you next week. All right, folks, you're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.